Hello, this is Brian, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the November 18th issue of the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The U.S. plan for Gaza won UN backing. Carrying it out could be far more difficult. The UN Security Council has backed the United States' ambitious plan for the future of the Gaza Strip. How and when it will be carried out remain largely unknown. In a twist unimaginable across the tumultuous history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the plan would mean U.S. President Donald Trump becomes the de facto ruler of Gaza. The territory remains devastated by Israel's campaign to eliminate Hamas after its October 7, 2023 attack that sparked the war. An international body known as the Board of Peace, chaired by Trump, is to govern Gaza and oversee reconstruction under a two-year renewable UN mandate. An armed international stabilization force is to keep security and ensure the disarming of Hamas, a key demand of Israel. Major questions hang over nearly every part of the plan and the time frame for implementation. In the meantime, nearly all Palestinians remain displaced and dependent on humanitarian aid. Hamas retains significant control over nearly half of Gaza, and the rebuilding of the territory has barely begun. Challenges at every step. Some talks over the next steps have taken place behind the scenes among the U.S., Israel, Qatar, Egypt, and other countries. But serious negotiations have not begun because Israel and Hamas remain in the first phase of the ceasefire deal that came into effect in October. The militant group is still required to hand over the bodies of the last three hostages. The UN resolution passed Monday gave it plan international legitimacy. That opens the door for Arab and Muslim-majority nations to participate, particularly by contributing troops to the ISF. The U.S. is hoping that the more those countries are involved, the more palatable the international rule will be for Gaza's more than 2 million people. But the Palestinian public's acceptance is far from certain. Without it, the Board of Peace risks becoming seen as a foreign occupation working on behalf of Israel, further thwarting their dream of self-determination and statehood. The plan gives Palestinians almost no voice in governing Gaza. Because of Israel's fierce opposition, it doesn't promise statehood, offering only a vague reference that it might one day be possible. It also gives only an ambiguous timetable for reconstruction to begin and for the Israeli military to withdraw from the around 50% of the Gaza Strip that it still holds since the ceasefire began. Will disarmament happen? Disarming Hamas and demilitarizing Gaza are the keystones to the whole plan, but there is no detail on how that will happen. So far, the militant group has not agreed to disarm. In a statement after the UN resolution's passage, Hamas said the fate of its weapons is connected to ensuring a path to the end of the Israeli occupation and the creation of a Palestinian state. The International Stabilization Force is tasked with ensuring disarmament and the destruction of Hamas's military infrastructure. The ISF will also oversee a Palestinian police force made up of vetted members trained by Egypt and Jordan. A number of nations have been cited as possible contributors to the ISF, including Egypt, Indonesia, Turkey, and Azerbaijan, but none has committed to sending troops yet, and Israel opposes Turkey participating in the force. They are unlikely to want their soldiers to take Hamas's weapons by force. Hamas warned that trying to do so would turn the ISF into a party to the conflict in favor of the occupation. Hamas is under heavy pressure, particularly from Qatar and Egypt, to find a compromise. One possible idea is a decommissioning, handing the arsenal over to the ISF for safekeeping, which Hamas could argue is not a permanent surrender of its right to armed resistance. Without disarmament, much of the rest of the plan could stall. Israel's troop withdrawal is linked to the pace of Hamas demilitarization and the deployment of the ISF. Reconstruction is also unlikely to happen in most of Gaza unless Hamas disarms. Many Palestinians fear the end result will be a partition of Gaza between an Israeli-controlled zone, where some reconstruction might take place, and the rest, where almost all of the population, more than 2 million, live with little rebuilding. Who will make up the Board of Peace? Trump has said the board will be made up of distinguished leaders from other countries, including former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, and that its members will be named in the coming weeks. But who they will be is unknown, and even Blair's participation has not been confirmed. The UN resolution gives the board complete say in Gaza with powers over the ISF, reconstruction, and economic recovery. The board is also to oversee a technocratic, apolitical committee of competent Palestinians who will run the day-to-day civil service in Gaza. Who are these independent Palestinians? The members of the Palestinian committee are to have no connection to either Hamas or the Palestinian Authority, which currently administers scattered parts of the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Israel has rejected any role for the PA in Gaza. The plan doesn't specify who will select the members, but that likely will fall to the Board of Peace. Israel will want to have a strong say in who can be included. In an online post, Palestinian political analyst and pollster Khalil Shikaki said the committee should be picked through an all-Palestinian process to boost its support, consulting among political factions, trade syndicates, local leaders, and women's and youth organizations. But if the board and the committee are seen as a tool for the U.S. or Israel, prominent Palestinians may be reluctant to join. In its statement Monday, Hamas denounced the international guardianship that the UN resolution places on Gaza, saying it aims to further Israel's interests. What is all this leading to? The plan emphasizes two goals for Gaza, demilitarization and reconstruction. Anything beyond that remains largely blank. The UN resolution offers the possibility of the Palestinian Authority eventually taking control of Gaza if it carries out a slate of internal reforms to the satisfaction of the Board of Peace, everything from fighting corruption, increasing efficiency, to holding elections. The Palestinian Authority welcomed the UN resolution in a statement Monday and said it was prepared to step in to govern Gaza, but Israeli opposition raises doubts whether that will ever be allowed to happen. Under pressure from Arab allies, the United States inserted a reference to Palestinian statehood in the UN resolution. But it remains only a vague nod. It states that if the Palestinian Authority faithfully carries out reforms, and if Gaza redevelopment advances, conditions may finally be in place for a credible pathway to Palestinian self-determination and statehood. The lack of a clear path to self-determination threatens to complicate every other step. For example, Shikaki wrote, "Without a path to statehood, disarmament will be seen as capitulation. With it, immobilization can be framed as part of national strategy. For much of the population, the priority is to see reconstruction and a revival of Gaza's economy so families have livelihoods. If that comes, it could paper over reluctance toward international rule, at least for a time. If it doesn't, or if Palestinians see no progress toward self-determination, resentment is likely to mount. The potential for chaos is high with the multiple divisions within Gaza. Already, the territory has Hamas, several Israeli-backed armed gangs that oppose the militant group, and the Israeli military itself. Add to those a Palestinian police force, international troops, Palestinians who join the administration, and those who oppose it, and the scene becomes even more volatile." Convicted fraudster who had sentence commuted by Trump gets 37 years for new fraud conviction. A New Jersey man whose lengthy prison sentence for fraud convictions was commuted by President Donald Trump in 2021 is now headed back to federal prison for another fraud conviction. U.S. District Judge Michael Shipp, sitting in Trenton, handed down a 37-year sentence on Friday to Eli Weinstein, 51, of Lakewood, who is also known as Mike Koenig. Schiff also ruled that Weinstein must pay $44,294,803 in restitution, which is due immediately, according to court documents. Weinstein was convicted in March on charges he helped defraud dozens of investors out of $35 million. Prosecutors have said Weinstein and others falsely promised investors access to deals involving scarce medical supplies, baby formula, and first aid kits supposedly destined for wartime Ukraine. This marked the third time Weinstein had been convicted in a New Jersey federal court for defrauding investors. The first case involved a real estate Ponzi scheme, and the second stemmed from additional fraud he committed while on pretrial release. For those latter two cases, which resulted in combined losses to investors of approximately $230 million, Weinstein was sentenced to 24 years in prison. On January 19, 2021, day before leaving office during his first term, Trump commuted Weinstein's term to time served after less than 8 years into his sentence. Shortly after he was released, Weinstein began orchestrating the scheme for which he was sentenced last week, prosecutors have said. Zelensky visits Picasso's Guernica painting after drawing parallel to Ukraine's bombing. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky made a one-day visit Tuesday to Spain and seized the opportunity to view Pablo Picasso's Guernica. It was a move laden with symbolism. Among the last century's most famous paintings, Guernica depicts the horrors of war, specifically the bombardment of civilian targets. The enormous black, gray, and white painting features screaming women, flailing horses, and a gored bull. Picasso used them to represent the bombing by Nazi and fascist Italian warplanes of the town named Guernica in 1937 during Spain's Civil War. The painting's distorted cubist figures have since become a symbol of suffering, violence, and resistance. At the United Nations, a tapestry of it hangs at the entry to the Security Council's chamber, where Russia is one of five nations with a permanent seat. Zelensky referenced the painting before, in April 2022, while remotely addressing Spain's parliament just months into Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, he said, "Imagine that people now, in Europe, live for weeks in basements to save lives. From shelling from air bombs daily, April 2022, and the reality in Ukraine is as if it's April 1937, when the whole world learned the name of one of your cities, Guernica." The painting has had other famous visitors. Former U.S. President Barack Obama viewed it in 2018 on a visit with Spain's King Felipe VI. The novelist Salman Rushdie came to see Guernica too, a few years after a stabbing attack that cost him vision in one eye. "Guernica is possibly the world's first anti-war painting," said Giles Tremlett, a historian who has written extensively about Spain under former dictator General Francisco Franco. "It represents something that has had continuity since then, and today is highly visible in Ukraine, so it seems highly apt." Spain's civil war ended in 1939, after which Franco ruled as a dictator until his death on November 20, 1975, almost exactly 50 years ago. Picasso had forbidden the painting from being shown in Spain while Franco remained in power, so it was lent to New York's Museum of Modern Art in 1939 and displayed there for decades. The painting returned to Spain in 1981, months after Spain's young democracy survived an attempted military coup that was considered the last serious attempt to revert its transition to democracy. When Guernica came to Spain in 1981, "For us, it was a symbol of hope that there was no way Spain was going back," said Antonio Cazorla Sanchez, a professor of Spanish history at Trent University in Canada. Zelensky's tour of European capitals, including Spain, underscores Kiev's urgent need to reassure allies and continue to shore up support for Ukraine. Engaging partners through speeches to parliaments and appearances at major forums has become a hallmark of his leadership. Those efforts come amid growing pressures at home and abroad as a damaging corruption scandal and other domestic strains threaten to distract attention from the war effort. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. House votes overwhelmingly to force release of Epstein files, sending bill to Senate. The House voted overwhelmingly in favor of a bill Tuesday to force the Justice Department to publicly release its files on the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, a remarkable display of approval for an effort that had struggled for months to overcome opposition from President Donald Trump and Republican leadership. When a small bipartisan group of House lawmakers introduced a petition in July to maneuver around House Speaker Mike Johnson's control of which bills reached the House floor, it appeared a long-shot effort, especially as Trump urged his supporters to dismiss the matter as a hoax. But both Trump and Johnson failed in their efforts to prevent the vote. Now the president has bowed to the growing momentum behind the bill and even said he will sign it if it also passes the Senate. The bill passed 427-1, with the only no vote coming from Representative Clay Higgins, a Louisiana Republican, who is a fervent supporter of Trump. He also chairs a subcommittee that initiated a subpoena on the Justice Department for the Epstein files. Tuesday's vote further showed the pressure mounting on lawmakers and the Trump administration to meet long-held demands that the Justice Department release its case files on Epstein. A well-connected financier who killed himself in a Manhattan jail while awaiting trial in 2019 on charges he sexually abused and trafficked underage girls. These women have fought the most horrific fight that no woman should have to fight, and they did it by banding together and never giving up, said Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene as she stood with some of the abuse survivors outside the Capitol Tuesday morning. That's what we did by fighting so hard against the most powerful people in the world, even the President of the United States, in order to make this vote happen today, added Greene, a Georgia Republican and longtime Trump loyalist. A separate investigation conducted by the House Oversight Committee has released thousands of pages of emails and other documents from Epstein's estate showing his connection to global leaders, Wall Street power brokers, influential political figures, and Trump himself. In the United Kingdom, King Charles III stripped his disgraced brother, Prince Andrew, of his remaining titles and evicted him from his royal residence after pressure to act over his relationship with Epstein. Pushing for more accountability, the survivors of Epstein's abuse cast the current effort in Congress as a step towards accountability for Epstein's crimes after years of government failure under multiple presidential administrations. Trump's reversal on the Epstein files. Trump has said he cut ties with Epstein years ago, but tried for months to move past the demands for disclosure. On Monday, he told reporters that Epstein was connected to more Democrats and that he didn't want the Epstein files to detract from the great success of the Republican Party. Still, many in the Republican base have continued to demand the release of the files. Adding to that pressure, several survivors of Epstein's abuse rallied outside the Capitol Tuesday morning, bundled in jackets against the November chill and holding photos of themselves as teenagers, they recounted their stories of abuse. We are exhausted from surviving the trauma and then surviving the political conflicts that surround it, said Jenna Lisa Jones, one of the survivors. She added that she had voted for Trump, but had a message for the president. I beg you, Donald Trump, please stop making this political. The group of women also met with Johnson and rallied outside the Capitol in September, but have had to wait months for the vote. That's because Johnson kept the House closed for legislative business for nearly 2 months and also refused to swear in Democratic Representative Edlita Grijalva of Arizona during the government shutdown. After winning a special election on September 23, Grijalva had pledged to provide the crucial 218th vote to the petition for the Epstein Files bill, but only after she was sworn into office last week could she sign her name to the discharge petition to give it majority support in the 435-member House. It quickly became apparent the bill would pass, and both Johnson and Trump began to fold. Trump on Sunday said Republicans should vote for the bill, yet Green told reporters that Trump's decision to fight the bill had betrayed his Make America Great Again political movement. It's one of the reasons behind her prominent split with the president. Watching this turn into a fight has ripped MAGA apart, she said. How Johnson is handling the bill. Rather than waiting until next week for the discharge position to officially take effect, Johnson is moving to hold the vote under a procedure that requires a two-thirds majority. But Johnson also spent a morning news conference listing off problems that he sees with the legislation. He argued that the bill could have unintended consequences by disclosing parts of federal investigations that are usually kept private, including information on victims. This is a raw and obvious political exercise, Johnson said. Still, he planned to vote for the bill. None of us want to go on record and in any way be accused of not being for maximum transparency, he added. Meanwhile, House Democrats celebrated the vote as a rare win for the minority. It's a complete and total surrender, because as Democrats, we made clear from the very beginning the survivors and the American people deserve full and complete transparency as it relates to the lives that were ruined by Jeffrey Epstein, said House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries. What will the Senate do? It's not clear how the Senate will handle the bill. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican South Dakota, has previously been circumspect when asked about the legislation and instead said he trusted the Justice Department to release information on the Epstein investigation. But what the Justice Department has released so far under Trump was mostly already public. The bill would go further, forcing the release within 30 days of all files and communications related to Epstein, as well as any information about the investigation into his death in federal prison. Information about Epstein's victims or continuing federal investigations would be allowed to be redacted, but not information due to embarrassment, reputational harm, or political sensitivity, including to any government official, public figure, or foreign dignitary. Johnson also said he wants to see the Senate amend the bill to protect the information of victims and whistleblowers. But the bipartisan pair who sponsored the bill, Representatives Thomas Massey, Republican Kentucky, and Ro Khanna, Democrat California, warned senators against doing anything that would muck it up and said they would face the same public uproar that forced both Trump and Johnson to back down. We've needlessly dragged this out for 4 months, Massey said, adding that those raising problems with the bill are afraid that people will be embarrassed. Well, that's the whole point here. Trump dismisses U.S. intelligence that Saudi prince was likely aware of 2018 killing of journalists. President Donald Trump on Tuesday dismissed U.S. intelligence findings that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman likely had some culpability in the 2018 killing of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi, as Trump warmly welcomed the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia on his first White House visit in 7 years. The U.S.-Saudi relationship had, for a time, been sent into a tailspin by the operation targeting Khashoggi, a fierce critic of the kingdom. But 7 years later, the dark clouds over the relationship have been cleared away, and Trump has tightened his embrace of the 40-year-old crown prince, who he said is an indispensable player in shaping the Middle East in the decades to come. Prince Mohammed, for his part, denies involvement in the killing of Khashoggi, who was a Saudi citizen and Virginia resident. Whether you like him or don't like him, things happen, Trump said of the international incident when asked about it by a reporter during an Oval Office appearance with Prince Mohammed. But he knew nothing about it, and we can leave it at that. You don't have to embarrass our guests by asking a question like that. But U.S. intelligence officials determined that the Saudi Crown Prince likely approved the killing by Saudi agents of U.S.-based journalists inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. According to U.S. findings declassified in 2021 at the start of the Biden administration, Trump officials, during his first administration, refused to release the report. Prince Mohammed said Saudi Arabia did all the right steps to investigate Khashoggi's death. It's painful and it's a huge mistake, he said. Trump even commended the Saudi leader for strides made by the kingdom on human rights without providing any specific detail. I'm very proud of the job he's done, Trump said. What he's done is incredible in terms of human rights and everything else. The Crown Prince, for his part, announced Saudi Arabia was increasing its planned investments in the U.S. to $1 trillion, up from $600 billion that the Saudis said they planned to invest in the United States when Trump visited the kingdom in May. Echoing rhetoric that Trump likes to use, the Crown Prince used the moment in front of the cameras to flatter the Republican leader by calling the U.S. the hottest country on the planet for investment. What you're creating is not about an opportunity today, it's also about long-term opportunity, Prince Mohammed said. Trump's family has a strong personal interest in the kingdom. In September, London real estate developer Dar Global announced that it plans to launch Trump Plaza in the Red Sea city of Jeddah. It's Dar Global's second collaboration with the Trump Organization, the collection of companies controlled by the U.S. President's children, in Saudi Arabia. Last year, the two companies announced the launch of Trump Tower Jeddah. Trump pushed back on suggestions that there could be a conflict of interest in his family's dealings with the Saudis. I have nothing to do with the family business, Trump said. Rolling out the red carpet, Trump warmly received Prince Mohammed when he arrived at the White House Tuesday morning for a pomp-filled arrival ceremony that included a military flyover and a thundering greeting from the U.S. Marine Band. Technically, it's not a state visit because the Crown Prince is not the head of state, but Prince Mohammed has taken charge of the day-to-day governings for his father, King Salman, 89, who has endured health problems in recent years. Trump showed the prince the newly installed Presidential Walk of Fame that features gold-framed images of past presidents along the West Wing colonnade and a photo of an auto pen signing the name of former President Joe Biden in place of the Democrat's official portrait. Trump will then see the Crown Prince off in the afternoon, but he's expected to return to the South Lawn with the First Lady to welcome the Crown Prince when he returns for the evening East Room dinner. Cristiano Ronaldo, the Portuguese soccer great who is playing in the Saudi Pro League, is also expected to be at the White House on Tuesday during the Crown Prince's visit, according to a White House official who was not authorized to comment publicly and spoke on the condition of anonymity. In addition to White House pomp, the two nations are also planning an investment summit at the Kennedy Center on Wednesday that will include the heads of Salesforce, Qualcomm, Pfizer, the Cleveland Clinic, Chevron, and Aramco, Saudi Arabia's national oil and natural gas company, where even more deals with the Saudis could be announced. Fighter jets and business deals. Ahead of Prince Mohammed's arrival, Trump announced he has agreed to sell the Saudis F-35 fighter jets despite some concerns within the administration that the sale could lead to China gaining access to the U.S. technology behind the advanced weapons system. Trump's announcement is also surprising because some in the Republican administration have been wary about upsetting Israel's qualitative military edge over its neighbors, especially at a time when Trump is depending on Israeli support for the success of his Gaza peace plan. But the unexpected move comes at a moment when Trump is trying to nudge the Saudis toward normalizing relations with Israel. The president, in his first term, had helped forge commercial and diplomatic ties between Israel and Bahrain Morocco and the United Arab Emirates through an effort dubbed the Abraham Accords. Trump sees expansion of the Accords as essential to his broader efforts to build stability in the Middle East after the two-year Israel-Hamas war in Gaza. And getting Saudi Arabia, the largest Arab economy and the birthplace of Islam, to sign on would spur a domino effect, he argues. The president in recent weeks has even predicted that once Saudi Arabia signs onto the Accords, everybody in the Arab world goes in. But the Saudis have maintained that a clear path toward Palestinian statehood must first be established before normalizing relations with Israel can be considered. The Israelis, meanwhile, remain steadfastly opposed to the creation of a Palestinian state. We want to be part of the Abraham Accords, but we want also to be sure that we secure a clear path of two-state solution, said the Crown Prince, adding that the two leaders had a robust discussion on the issue. Assurances on U.S. military support. The Saudis, during the visit, are also looking to receive formal assurances from Trump, defining the scope of U.S. military protection for the kingdom, even though anything not ratified by Congress can be undone by the next president. Prince Mohammed also wants to use the visit to reestablish his position as a global player. He says he's determined to diversify the Saudi economy away from oil by investing in sectors like mining, technology, and tourism. To that end, Saudi Arabia is expected to announce a multi-billion-dollar investment in U.S. artificial intelligence infrastructure, and the two countries will lay out details about new cooperation in the civil nuclear energy sector during the visit. According to a senior Trump administration official, who was not authorized to comment publicly ahead of the formal announcement, a coalition of 11 human rights groups ahead of the Crown Prince's visit called on the Trump administration to use its leverage to press Saudi authorities, who badly want to broaden its business and defense connections with the U.S., to make concrete commitments on human rights and press freedom during the visit. The activists say Saudi authorities continue to harshly repress dissent, including by arresting human rights defenders, journalists, and political dissidents for criticism against the kingdom. Human rights organizations have also documented a surge in executions in Saudi Arabia that they connect to an effort to suppress internal dissent. U.S. officials should be pressing for change, not posing for photos, said Sarah Yeager, Washington director at the group Human Rights Watch, said in a statement. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Mexico rejects Trump's offer of military strikes against cartels again. Mexico's president on Tuesday ruled out allowing U.S. strikes against cartels on Mexican soil a day after U.S. President Donald Trump said he was willing to do whatever it takes to stop drugs entering the U.S. It's not going to happen, Mexico's president Claudia Sheinbaum said Tuesday. He, Trump, has suggested it on various occasions, or he has said, "We offer you a United States military intervention in Mexico, whatever you need to fight the criminal groups," she said. "But I have told him on every occasion that we can collaborate, that they can help us with information they have, but that we operate in our territory, that we do not accept any intervention by a foreign government." Sheinbaum said she had said it to Trump and to U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and that they have understood. "Would I want strikes in Mexico to stop drugs? Okay with me, whatever we have to do to stop drugs," Trump said Monday, adding that he's not happy with Mexico. The U.S. Embassy in Mexico shared a video through social platform X later Monday that included previous comments from Rubio saying that the U.S. would not take unilateral action in Mexico. Meanwhile, Mexican and U.S. diplomats were trying to sort out Tuesday what may have been an actual U.S. incursion. On Monday, men arrived in a boat to a beach in northeast Mexico and installed some signs signaling land that the U.S. Department of Defense considered restricted. Mexico's Foreign Affairs Ministry said late Monday that the country's navy had removed the signs, which appeared to be on Mexican territory. And on Tuesday, Sheinbaum said that the International Boundary and Water Commission, a binational agency that determines the border between the two countries, was getting involved. The signs, driven into the sand near where the Rio Grande empties into the Gulf of Mexico, caused a stir when witnesses said men in a boat arrived at the local beach known as Playa Baghdad and directed them. The signs read in English and Spanish, "Warning, restricted area," and went on to explain that it was Department of Defense property and had been declared restricted by the commander. It said that there could be no unauthorized access, photography, or drawings of the area. The U.S. Embassy in Mexico and the Pentagon did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Mexico contacted its consulate in Brownsville, Texas, and then the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City. Eventually, it was determined that contractors working for some U.S. government entity had placed the signs, Sheinbaum said. But the river changes its course, it breaks loose, and according to the treaty, you have to clearly demarcate the national border, Sheinbaum said during her daily press briefing. The area is close to SpaceX Starbase, which sits adjacent to Boca Chica Beach on the Texas side of the Rio Grande. The facility and launch site for the SpaceX rocket program is under contract with the Department of Defense and NASA, which hopes to send astronauts back to the moon and someday to Mars. In June, Sheinbaum said the government was looking into contamination from the SpaceX facility after pieces of metal, plastic, and rocket pieces were reportedly found on the Mexican side of the border following the explosion of a rocket during a test. The area also carries the added sensitivity of Trump's order to rename the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America, which Mexico has also rejected. Neo-Nazi leader admits plot to give poisoned candy to Jewish kids in New York City. The leader of an Eastern European neo-Nazi group has pleaded guilty in New York to trying to recruit others to commit violent attacks against Jews and racial minorities, including one plot that would have involved dressing as Santa Claus to hand out poisoned candy to children. Federal prosecutors said they would seek a sentence of up to 18 years for Mikhail Shilkovishvili, a 22-year-old from the Republic of Georgia who goes by the nickname Commander Butcher. He pleaded guilty Monday before a federal judge in Brooklyn to soliciting hate crimes and distributing information about making bombs and ricin. Prosecutors described Shilkovishvili as the leader of the Maniac Murder Cult, an internationalist extremist group that adheres to an ideology that promotes violence intended to trigger a racial and religious war. They said the group's violent solicitations, promoted through Telegram channels and outlined a manifesto called the Hater's Handbook, appear to have inspired multiple real-life killings, including a school shooting in Nashville, Tennessee earlier this year that left a 16-year-old student dead. Shilkovishvili was arrested in July 2024 in Moldova. He was extradited to the United States in May. Since 2022, Shilkovishvili has traveled on multiple occasions to Brooklyn, where he bragged about beating up an elderly Jewish man and instructed others, primarily through text messages, to commit violent acts on behalf of the Maniac Murder Cult, according to prosecutors. When he was approached by an undercover FBI agent in 2023, Shilkovishvili recruited the official to various schemes, including one that would have involved dressing up as Santa Claus to give poison candy to racial minorities, according to prosecutors. The plot later evolved into poisoning children at Jewish schools in Brooklyn, prosecutors said. prosecutor said in a court filing that when Chikichvili described his desire to carry out a mass casualty attack in the United States, he said he saw the country as having big potential because of easy access to firearms. They also said he suggested targeting homeless people because the government wouldn't care even if they die. ...160 Ukrainian energy workers have been killed as Russia pummels the power system. Friends often ask Mykhailo whether the Ukrainian power plant worker hides in a shelter when Russia bombards the energy system. If all the turbine operators hid during attacks, there'd be no energy left, he said, standing inside the machine hall of a thermal power plant. We have to stay at our posts. Who else would do the job? Almost 4 years into Russia's invasion, keeping Ukraine's lights on has become a battle of its own, fought along a moving front line. Engineers repeatedly repair transformers, switchyards, and power lines that Russia strikes again and again, while using bomb-laden drones to hunt workers' trucks near the border. And that work repairing damage from Russian attacks is happening when a major embezzlement and kickback scandal at the state-owned nuclear power company has put top officials under scrutiny. Since the war began, at least 160 energy workers have been killed, including a colleague of Mykhailo's. More than 300 others have been wounded, yet tens of thousands still head out each day, sometimes fearful, sometimes resigned, often driven by a quiet mission to bring light through the darkness. Mykhailo has worked in the energy sector for 23 years and never imagined his daily reality could be so perilous. Mykhailo spoke on condition that his surname and that of his former colleague, Dmytro, not be used because of heightened security concerns about his location. Mykhailo was just a few meters away when Dmytro was killed. I was simply luckier, Mykhailo said quietly. The AP had met Dmytro in 2024 after an earlier strike on the plant. At the time, Dmytro said he would work as long as I can. He died 7 months later. Energy workers become targets. In the northern city of Chernihiv, Andrei Duhuma, 58, has spent more than three decades replacing and repairing the same power lines he helped build when old wooden poles were swapped for new concrete ones, and Ukraine was still part of the Soviet Union. Since the war began, Huma has patched nearly 65 miles of damaged wires, not to modernize, but to restore what's been shattered. Somehow, but we still give people light, he said. He is proud of his work, even though it makes him a potential target. For many energy workers, that realization changes little in their routine. They keep showing up. Better I become a target for Russia than civilians or soldiers, said 24-year-old Bodan Balos, dressed in his work uniform while repairing power lines in the northern town of Shotska, which was plunged into blackout last month after heavy strikes. Balos said his shifts often stretch more than 12 hours, sometimes under the buzz of drones. If one hits me, of course, it'll be sad for everyone, but I'll be glad it wasn't a child or a residential building. In a way, it's kind of a self-sacrifice. On October 10, crane operator Anatoly Savchenko, 47, was struck by a drone while driving home from a substation in the Chernihiv region. While he survived that initial strike, a second drone hit after colleagues gathered together to help him. Savchenko and worker Ruslan Dinega, 45, were both killed. Nobody thought that this would happen, said Lyudmila Savchenko, Anatoly's widow, especially since they were already returning home. Energy workers know people depend on them. For Alexander Adamchuk, a repair and maintenance supervisor for substations in the Kiev region, his work has become a mission. The main thing is that our soldiers hold the front so the Russians don't come here, Adamchuk said. We'll do everything to make sure people don't freeze this winter. Called in the middle of the night, he gathers his team within a half hour and rushes to a drone-damaged substation. Their job is as urgent as that of rescuers, says Adamchuk, who lived through the Russian occupation of his village early in the war. Their heat, comfort, and quality of life depends on us. Electrical equipment the West provides for repairs is vital, he said. They give us the resources to keep repairing. We'll keep restoring and restoring, no matter if we fixed it yesterday and it's hit again today. That's our fate, our mission. There's no such thing as tiredness, he added, sitting at home after a long day as his three children swirl around him. His youngest son, born during the war, clings to his arm. What tiredness? He has three kids, his wife, Olena Adamchuk, interjects with a laugh. He rests at work. They both laugh, but they know the risks are real. Of course, we understand the danger, Alexander Adamchuk said. His work allows him to be away from substations during air raids, but not every energy worker is that lucky. Light doesn't come from machines. The danger often weighs on workers' morale, Mikhailo said, but most hide their fear, and they joke and support each other. Returning after Dmytro's death was not easy. No one chained me here. I could leave any time, Mikhailo said. But if I quit, I lose my specialty, and most likely, I'd have to go to the front line. He sees no good options. It's scary and hard mentally, Mikhailo said. You go to work knowing that maybe you can be killed, and you just do it through effort and willpower. Dmytro began working in energy in 1995. After Russian forces invaded in 2022, he fled his hometown in southern Ukraine after it was occupied. His safety was at risk because he refused to sign a contract with Moscow-installed authorities at the energy facility where he worked. Dmytro's wife, Tatiana, described him as reliable, loving, kind, and bright, and said he knew the risks with his job. I often saw fear in his eyes when he went to work, she said. That day, as he was leaving, he noted that Russian missiles had entered Ukraine's airspace, she said. Light doesn't come from machines. It comes from people who risk their lives to bring it, Tatiana said. If they stop going to work, there will be no gas, no heat, no light. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Chinese ship jams communications as Filipino forces deliver supplies to Philippines' occupied shoal. Philippine forces transported food, fuel, and new personnel to a territorial outpost in a long-disputed shoal in the South China Sea, where Chinese government ships jammed communications during the hours-long supply mission as part of Beijing's security practice in the far-flung atoll, two top officials in the Philippines said Tuesday. The transport by the armed forces of the Philippines of supplies and a fresh batch of Navy personnel to the second Thomas Shoal was successfully conducted without any untoward incident Friday, despite the presence of Chinese Coast Guard and other ships, which have been guarding the periphery of the Philippines-occupied shoal for years, the officials told the Associated Press. They did not elaborate and spoke on condition of anonymity because of the issue's sensitivity. Chinese officials did not immediately issue a statement. They have previously claimed the fishing atoll and virtually the entire South China Sea and have repeatedly demanded the Philippines pull away a grounded warship, the BRP Sierra Madre, from the second Thomas Shoal. One of the officials said the Chinese Coast Guard jammed communications in and around the shoal while Philippine forces were delivering supplies to the Sierra Madre, apparently to prevent possible drone surveillance by the United States and other foreign forces, which have committed to help preserve the rule of the law in the South China Sea, a key global trade route. The Philippine military has carried out 12 such deliveries of supplies and new personnel without incident to the long-grounded Sierra Madre since last year. Confrontations have been averted after China and the Philippines signed a temporary non-aggression arrangement in July 2024 to prevent new confrontations in the fishing atoll, which both Asian countries have long claimed. In August, however, China deployed more Coast Guard and suspected militia ships to the closely guarded shoal, including some with more powerful machine guns backed by a helicopter and an unmanned surveillance drone. At the time, a Chinese Coast Guard ship was spotted firing its powerful water cannon in an apparent drill or an intimidating gesture, and a Chinese boat came as close as 164 feet to the Sierra Madre. The Chinese vessel was blocked by two boatloads of Filipino forces from coming closer to the Filipino ship outpost, the Philippine military said. The Philippine military deliberately grounded the Sierra Madre in the turquoise shallows of the Second Thomas Shoal in 1999 to serve as a territorial outpost. China, which also claims the shoal, later surrounded the atoll with its own ships. The years-long territorial standoff has caused frequent face-offs between Philippine military supply boats and Chinese forces in the past, until Filipino and Chinese diplomats forged the non-aggression arrangement last year covering the shoal, a landmark deal between two claimant Asian states. Vietnam, Malaysia, Brunei, and Taiwan also have overlapping territorial claims in the sea passage. The U.S. lays no claims to the waters, but has repeatedly warned it is obligated to defend the Philippines, its oldest treaty ally in Asia, if Filipino forces, aircraft, and ships come under an armed attack, including in the South China Sea. Nations hit by natural disasters tell ministers at climate talks to act. Battered by last month's ferocious climate-fueled hurricane, Jamaica joined other small island nations and impoverished countries at Monday's United Nations climate talks to implore the rest of the world to stop talking and start acting. Their message, our lives are on the line. As high-level ministers from governments around the world took over negotiations at the conference called COP30, vulnerable nations lined up to say how important it is for countries to cut emissions. They said the world's current climate plans aren't strong enough to keep warming below the 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit set by the 2015 Paris Agreement. In addition, they renewed a long-standing call for rich nations to do more financially to help poor countries deal with warming. Hurricane Melissa changed the life of every Jamaican in less than 24 hours, said Matthew Samota, the country's economic growth minister. The Category 5 hurricane that hit 3 weeks ago caused almost $10 billion in damage and displaced hundreds of thousands of people. He called it evidence of the new phase of climate change. We did not create this crisis, but we refused to stand as victims, Samota said. We call on the global community, especially major emitters, to honor their commitments and safeguard the 1.5 degree threshold for Jamaica. This is survival. It's about our people and their right to a safe and prosperous future. Armando Rodriguez Batista, Cuba's environment and science minister, noted his country was flooded by Melissa. Tomorrow it will be too late to do what we had to do a long time ago, he said. Speakers lament slow progress. Other nations reiterated the life-or-death nature of stepping up to fight to cut emissions, calling it a moral duty and saying climate damage is their day-to-day reality. I sit on the roof of the house all night, looking at the neighbors, thinking whether or not the water will swallow us all, Romanian Environment Minister Diana Anda Buzionu said, reading the words of a victim of this year's floods in her country. Promises alone will not hold back the rising seas, Seychelles Environment and Climate Minister Flavian Flamel-Gerber said. A ruling earlier this year by the International Court of Justice that climate change is a planetary existential problem that must be fixed is leverage that small island countries will use to speed up climate fighting efforts at COP30, said Tuvalu Attorney General Landane Italia. That ruling shows that the 1.5 target is not just a political aspiration, but a legal obligation informed by the best available science. Tuvalu Environment and Climate Minister Maina Vakufua Talia said as thunder from a passing storm reverberated through the hall, "We are seeing the 1.5 target disappear before our eyes," Talia said, adding that for small islands, it is the line between our survival and loss. But stronger climate plans and saving 1.5 is important for the whole world, not just small islands, he added. COP30, more heavily fortified after a pair of demonstrations disrupted the main venue in the first week, kicked off its second week with foreign and other ministers stepping in for the lower-level negotiators who handled it earlier. They have far more power and leeway to make tough political decisions, and UN Climate Executive Secretary Simon Steele told them to use it. "The spirit is there, but the speed is not," Steele said. "The pace of change in the real economy has not been matched by the pace of progress in these negotiating rooms, as climate disasters wreck millions of lives and hammer every economy, pushing up prices for food and other basic needs. We all know what's at stake." Other speakers also urged quicker action. "The time for promises is over," Brazil Vice President Geraldo Alckmin said. "Each additional fraction of a degree of global warming represents lives at risk, greater inequality, and greater losses for those who contributed least to the problem." UN General Assembly President Annalena Baerbock said recent disasters show how much needs to be done. "The climate crisis is unrelenting," she said. "We saw this when Hurricane Melissa barreled into the Caribbean 2 weeks ago. We saw it again last week at the Philippines, near back-to-back typhoons. Our existence is at stake." Adding to the pressure, late Sunday, the Brazilian presidency of the talks issued a 5-page summary on how to proceed on several sticky issues. Those include pressing nations to do more in their new emissions-cutting plans, handling of trade disputes and barriers involving climate, and the need to deliver on last year's $300 billion annual pledge for climate financial aid to poor nations. Those difficult issues weren't part of the original agenda, nor the COP30 presidency's plans, but several countries pushed for them. Several countries, especially small island nations, have asked that the talks address the inadequacy of the emissions-cutting plans submitted by 116 nations so far this year. Collectively, the plans come nowhere close to cutting heat-trapping gases enough to prevent breaching the 1.5 degrees Celsius warming limit since the 1800s. That issue may get combined with a call for a plan for phasing out fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, the chief cause of climate change. That phase-out was agreed to after much debate at UN climate talks 2 years ago, but last year, little happened on the issue. Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva earlier this month raised the issue anew. "Our very existence is at stake," Mauritius Foreign Affairs Minister Danana J. Romfel said. "A decade after the promises of the Paris Agreement, despite our good intentions, we realize that we have not done enough. Our planet demands action now." You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the November 18th issue of the Toronto Star. Your reader has been Brian. Thank you for listening.